So it was just a war of attrition now, with only one clear outcome. He thought of pulling out his phone and calling Decker, if for no other reason than to tell him what was happening and to take charge of his body. But he decided against that. That was a defeatist attitude, and that was not really in Roby's DNA. He looked left and then right, searching for options as the group of men in front of him slowly moved forward. Just to show he wasn't to be toyed with, he focused on one man, leading the pack on the right. He watched the guy through the scope on his pistol and gauged his diversionary movements for about 10 seconds. He discerned the pattern and took aim with his pistol, and when the man stepped to his right, it was the last step of his life. As the man fell dead, Roby immediately rolled to his left and kept going as rounds poured into the location he had just occupied, his shot having given it away. Then the others ceased firing and hunkered down. Roby could imagine them using their compacts to assess the situation and arrive at a solution to the little problem represented by him. Roby didn't wait to confront the result of this discussion. He rolled to his left and kept rolling until he reached a planting bed that was full of dying flowers and small bushes. Tack lights were flying all over the ground as they searched for him from a safe distance, because there were limits to the accurate range of the subgun. It was designed to be devastating in close-quarter battle, but it was for shit at long range. He debated whether to use the tack beams as a convenient target to take out one or two of them, but doing so would only lead to overwhelming firepower directed at him, and he couldn't keep rolling out of danger. They would figure that out and send fields of fire in every direction he could possibly take. Then it became a numbers game, and one round would eventually find him. He assessed the situation again. It was a shit show, to be sure. But Roby had some more cards to play. He opened the duffel and took out two metal fist-sized canisters and a pair of headphones with a built-in battery. He put on the headphones and powered them up. He punched an engagement switch on each of the metal canisters, tossed one and then the other. They hit the dirt about 2 feet from his adversaries. The blinding flash of light was followed by an avalanche of sound, and far more lethally, sheets of packed shrapnel traveling at speeds no person could dodge. 2 seconds later, Roby got up and fired through the smoke, emptying his mag. Then he ran to his left toward the road using an evasive zigzag movement. He heard shots fired in his direction, but none hit their target. When he looked back, the smoke had cleared, and he was dismayed to see that 6 men were barreling toward him. They must have anticipated his tactic and had kept low enough to let the shrapnel sail harmlessly over them. He turned and fired his last mag at them. 2 went down, but the other 4 returned fire and kept charging. Okay, the shit show was turning into maybe his last stand. He dropped the empty subgun, pulled his pistol, knelt down, and took aim. He might very well get 2 of them before the other 2 got him. At this precise moment in time, that might be as near to perfection as was possible. He sighted through the scope on his Picatinny rail, as they were no doubt doing with him. He prepared himself mentally for the impact of the rounds that would end his life. Okay, Roby, it's been a good run, but all good runs have to come to an end. The next instant, one man dropped, then a second, then a third. They were all headshots, and bits of skull, flesh, and eruptions of blood covered the ground around the men as they went down. The shots were so rapid and so precise that they almost seemed to blend together into one round fired. The thing was, Roby had not pulled the trigger on his weapon. As the last man stopped and gazed around, wondering where the hell the shots were coming from, the next round pierced his skull and blew out the back of his head. He fell to the North Dakota soil without any last words. Roby rose from the ground and looked around, his pistol at the ready. Just because someone had taken out his enemies didn't mean they were necessarily his ally. He whirled when he heard the sounds of methodical footsteps coming across the road. He pointed his gun at the interloper. When the person came close enough for him to see, Roby was stunned for one of the very few times in his life. He lowered his weapon. What the hell are you doing here? Dressed all in black, Jessica Reel lowered her customized sniper rifle with her favorite scope attached. She looked him up and down, then surveyed the field of carnage behind them. Gazing back at him, she said,
"What else? Saving your ass."
Chapter 49.
"I want to know what the hell is going on," exclaimed Joe Kelly.
It was the next day, and he was standing next to Decker and Jameson as they surveyed the grounds in front of the abandoned apartment building. It was strewn with dead bodies with sheets over them. Hundreds of yellow markers, denoting found shell casings and bullets, covered the ground.
"Looks like quite a gun battle went on," observed Decker slowly. "That I can see," barked Kelly. "What I want to know is why."
"How should we know?" replied Decker calmly.
"Nothing like this ever happened before you guys showed up," replied Kelly testily.
"Doesn't mean it's cause and effect," pointed out Decker.
"Have you identified any of the bodies?"
asked Jameson.
"None have ID or any other traceable items, and they don't look American to me. At least most of them don't."
Decker glanced at Jameson and said to Kelly,
"Do you have photos of the dead?"
"Yeah, why?"
"I'd like to see them. Something might pop."
Kelly looked at him warily and then said,
"I'll get them. Don't go away."
As soon as he moved off, Jameson said,
"This is the building where Roby brought us to meet his boss."
"I'm well aware of that."
"Do you think Roby..."
"That's why I want to see the photos."
Jameson gazed around.
"It looks like a war zone."
Decker nodded.
"Kelly and his team have searched the building and it's empty, but there are signs out back of another gunfight and a rope dangling from a balcony."
"Have you tried to call Roby on that phone he left you?"
"To tell the truth, I'm afraid to try."
"You'll know soon enough. Here comes Kelly."
Kelly rejoined them and handed over an iPad on which were loaded photos of all the dead men. It took about a minute to go through them. Decker and Jameson exchanged a relieved glance when they saw that Roby was not among the pictures.
"I don't recognize any of these guys, but like you said, most of them seem foreign. Eastern Europe, the Middle East, a couple of Asians."
Kelly took the iPad back.
"It's a hodgepodge, all right."
"Have you spoken with Mark Sumpter?" asked Decker.
"Sumpter? Why?"
"Well, he heads up the military presence here. This might be something the Pentagon wants to know about."
"Okay, but it's not like the people under Sumpter came here and had a pitched battle and left all these dead guys."
"Well, you won't know for sure till you ask him," retorted Decker. "The government likes its secrets."
Kelly shook his head.
"It'll take us weeks to process this scene. You think the Bureau will send up more agents now?"
"Maybe," said Decker. "If we can show there's a terrorist angle to this."
"Terrorists!" exclaimed Kelly. "What would they be doing in North Dakota?"
"Well, that's our job to figure out."
They left Kelly and walked back to their SUV.
"You going to call Roby? I mean, he has to be involved in this."
"The probabilities lie there."
"But do you think he killed all those men? I mean, that seems impossible."
"Nothing about that guy seems impossible to me."
As they reached their vehicle, Decker's phone buzzed.
"It's Harper Brown," he said, checking the screen.
"Hopefully she has some news for us."
Decker answered the phone, and Harper Brown, their friend at the DIA, said,
"What the hell are you mixed up in out there, Decker?"
"I was hoping you could tell me. And how's Melvin?"
Melvin Mars was one of Decker's best friends, a former college football star convicted of murder and sentenced to death in Texas. Decker had proved his innocence. Mars and Brown were now dating.
"He's great. He sends his best and told me to tell you that if you need him as a bodyguard again, don't hesitate to call."
"I don't think I want him anywhere near this place. Besides, I think I have a pretty good bodyguard already."
"Don't let Alex hear you call her a bodyguard."
"I wasn't talking about her. So what do you have for us?"
"I'm thinking time is of the essence."
"Your thinking is spot on."
"First things first. Anyone I could find with first-hand knowledge of the Douglas S. George Defense Complex provided nothing helpful. It's been under Air Force control since the Korean War era when it was built."
"Has it been a radar array looking for missiles all that time?"
Strangely, she didn't answer right away.
"Well, it's hard to tell. From what I could find out, it didn't come online as an eye in the sky until the late 60s, well into the Cold War."
The Korean War was in the early 50s. What was it used for back then?
I don't know. I couldn't find out.
How is that possible? Don't you have every security clearance they give out?
I thought I did until I started asking questions about the place, particularly what it was doing back in the 50s. There I ran into a stone wall.
I understand there's another eye in the sky around here.
That's the other funny thing. The Stanley R. Mickelson Safeguard Complex is on the eastern side of the state and is part of the 21st Space Wing and designated Cavalier Air Force Station. It's near Grand Forks, North Dakota, and was deactivated in 1976. But it has a Parks radar array and keeps watch out for incoming missiles and also tracks objects in space.
Which was how the commanding officer at the facility here described what they do. A pair of eyes in North Dakota? Isn't that a bit of overkill? Especially considering the Cold War is long dead.
You would think, Decker, you would think.
She paused.
What do you believe is going on up there?
I think the answer to that would scare the crap out of even somebody like you. Chapter 50.
Things are accelerating, said Blue Man. He, Roby, and Reel were sitting in Reel's black SUV on a quiet road about a mile outside of London. In the distance, they could see oil rigs and crews pecking at the earth with drill bits and detonation guns.
The police are all over the property, noted Roby.
Well, there was no way we had the resources to clean up something like that, but that was a big loss for them, thanks to you.
Roby glanced at Reel.
Thanks to me and Jess. I thought you were on the other side of the world on assignment.
I was.
Reel was a female version of Roby, tall, lean, rock hard, with the calm and resolute features of a fighter pilot.
But then I got the call to come to wonderful North Dakota, where there were pressing matters that needed my attention.
You were following me? Said Roby, his features troubled.
I knew your itinerary. Otherwise, I would not have been able to. Don't worry, you're not losing a step.
Your timing was impeccable, I understand, noted Blue Man. I'm 6 feet under if she was a second later, added Roby. Jess and I checked some of the bodies out before we left the scene.
They weren't members of our military,
said Reel.
They weren't even from this country.
Foreigners on domestic soil, murmured Blue Man.
Which begs the question of why,
said Reel.
Roby said, Decker told us about the farmer who saw the man trying to escape, speaking gibberish.
A foreign language, possibly Arabic or perhaps Farsi. I believe Mr. Decker would have already come to a similar conclusion.
So it's a prison, then, said Roby.
Reel interjected.
It's no secret that some of the prisoners at Gitmo have been transferred to federal prisons across the country. But that Air Force facility is not a prison, at least not that anyone's told me.
Perhaps they haven't told anyone, suggested Blue Man.
What's going on with Gitmo now? Asked Roby.
Past administrations either tried to keep it open or shut it down. The latter turned out to be harder than it looked. It now costs about $13 million per prisoner. Currently, there are roughly 100 prisoners there.
So 1.3 billion bucks to house them,
said Reel.
A steep price, added Blue Man, but no one seems to know what to do about it.
So you think they transferred some of them up here, said Roby. Why?
I didn't say that, said Blue Man. These might be new prisoners. We're still fighting over there, of course. Taliban, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, even Houthian rebels and Iranian operatives, and other groups that are not as well known.
So that Air Force station might now be Gitmo too?
Asked Reel. And maybe doing things to prisoners that are no longer allowed at Gitmo 1, mused Blue Man.
Meaning torture?
I used to talk to the company line and say instead, enhanced interrogation techniques. But things like waterboarding, well, we need to call them what they are.
How in the world could something like that get authorized?
Said Reel.
And at a military facility? The DOD has always been against that sort of thing. It violates the Geneva Conventions and opens up American soldiers held as prisoners to the same kind of treatment.
It might not have been authorized,
At least not through the proper channels, said Blue Man. I think the politicians have learned their lesson on that one.
Which brings us to this, said Roby.
He took out a thumb drive and inserted it into the USB port on his laptop. He brought up the photos he had taken the previous night and turned it toward Blue Man.
This guy was meeting with Sumter, and whatever they're doing is definitely not on the up and up.
Blue Man looked at the pictures of the older man.
Recognize him?
Asked Real. Blue Man nodded.
Patrick McIntosh, a former obscure congressman who did little during his time in D.C. He has since made his mark, first as the head of a think tank, and now as a formidable lobbyist and kingmaker with a Rolodex that would rival anyone else's, and a desire to make as much money as possible by any means possible. He is supremely well-connected in all the corridors of power that matter.
Never heard of him, said Roby. Real nodded in agreement.
Which he would be delighted to hear. McIntosh does what he does from the shadows. The only time he seeks the limelight is when it suits him, usually accepting some honor for philanthropy that he performs only to keep in the good company of people he needs to further his own goals.
You sound like you know him well, said Roby. I've had my run-ins with him. I found him prepared, methodical, ruthless, shockingly lacking in empathy, and not above lying when it advantaged him in some way. Given that, I have always been surprised he didn't rise higher in government.
Roby passed Blue Man the recorder he had used to tape the conversation of the two men. You need to hear this.
Blue Man turned on the recorder and listened to the conversation with great interest. When it was done, he turned the recorder off and closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them, Roby said,
What will you do with that?
I will do what needs to be done, and I will move swiftly. If they are keeping a prison over there, we need to nip this in the bud as quickly and quietly as possible.
You need any help from us on that?
He held up the recorder. You've given me all I need. Real folded her arms over her chest and gave Blue Man a stern look.
And what's our next move?
The two of you will shadow Decker and Jameson. I'll let you know when you can fill them in on what you know and have them reciprocate. Based on our commingled intelligence, we can hopefully then map out a strategy going forward.
Do you think it wise to share what we know with them?
Said Real, looking surprised.
Roby said, We can trust them.
And since you saved Mr. Decker's life, I would think that he will believe he can trust you, said Blue Man. And he can, up to a point.
You see our agendas misaligning at some point? Queried Roby.
I have seen that happen before, so I can't say it won't happen now. We simply need to see how it plays out.
When do you want us to meet with them?
Now, said Blue Man. Whatever is being planned up here has a short fuse. I sense we have no time to waste. And it's not just this prison business. There's something else going on here that is far worse. A ticking time bomb reference does not provide for either restful sleep or dalliance. Now, drive me to the airstrip. I need to get back to D.C. as quickly as possible. I have many things to arrange and not much time to do so. And then, I have a meeting to attend.
Real put the SUV in gear, and they drove off.
Chapter 51 Amos Decker, Rex Manners, heard you wanted a line on an AWOL named Ben Purdy.
Decker had answered the call while sitting in his hotel room the next day.
That's right, Rex. Thanks for getting back to me. What do you have?
A name and an address. Beverly Purdy. She lives in Montana, a few hours from the border with North Dakota, which I understand is where you are now.
That's right.
Manners gave him the address.
Beverly Purdy is the mom. She's a widow, and Ben is her only kid. She lives on a farm, raises some crops and cattle. I don't know if Purdy is there or not, but it seemed like a good place for you to start.
I appreciate the assist. Be sure to email me a bill. I can give you my address.
Don't worry about it. PIs do each other favors. You'll be able to return it one day. Good luck.
Manners clicked off, and Decker put his phone away. He called Jameson and filled her in. When they Googled the location of Purdy's farm, they found it was about 5 hours from London.
Should we grab Kelly?
Asked Jameson.
I don't want to involve him in something that might come back to haunt him. There may come a time when we have to tell him, but now is not that time.
They met up downstairs and drove out of town, heading west.
Did you contact Roby?
Not yet. I was going to when the PI called. Let's check out Purdy, and then we can hook up with Roby when we get back.
The long drive seemed longer than it was because there was nothing to see except landscape that never changed.
I've never been in a car this long without seeing another car,
observed Jameson as she drove along.
And I grew up in Indiana.
This is big sky country.
Jameson looked out the window.
You got that right. You don't get this sort of impression in D.C. or New York.
Decker glanced at her wrist, where she had tatted Iron Butterfly.
You said your mother got you onto that band when you were a kid, after they reformed.
She smirked.
Wow, good memory.
Still listen to their music?
I've moved on to Janis Joplin and the Doors.
He glanced at her hand.
When I first met you, I noticed the slight indentation on your ring finger from when you were married before.
She glanced sharply at him.
I've never known you to make small talk. What gives?
Maybe I'm evolving.
Okay.
You've never really spoken about your ex. You just told me you were married for 2 years and 3 months. Then things went sideways. He wasn't the man you thought he was. And maybe you weren't the woman he thought you were.
She frowned.
Sometimes your perfect recall is really irritating.
How do you think I feel? So?
Nothing to really say about it other than what I already did. Dan was different when we dated. He was all things I liked. After we said our vows and started living together, he became all things I disliked. And maybe I became that way to him. Though, I don't think I ever really changed.
Amicable split?
We were both too young, and I was too naive. Way too naive. He took advantage of that. At least, thinking back, I see that.
Where is he now?
She shrugged.
Your guess is as good as mine.
She glanced at him again with an annoyed look that she finished off with a warm smile.
Right now, I think I liked it better when you had no interest at all in personal matters.
He held up his hands in mock surrender and then stared out the window.
When I woke up from my coma in the hospital after getting wrecked on that football field, I thought everything was normal. I thought I was still normal. Until it happened.
What happened?
You know the little monitor on the stand they have to record your vitals?
Yeah.
When I looked at the numbers there, I was seeing them in all sorts of different colors. At first, I just thought my vision was still funky, or maybe I was just out of sorts. You have to understand that I still didn't know what had happened to me. But later, when I looked at the clock on the wall, same thing, weird-ass colors. Then I knew I was definitely not the same. And when I had to interact with people, well, it was a brave new world. I'm sure the doctors and nurses were glad to be rid of me. I was a royal pain in the ass. I was somebody else, but only in the same body. My way of coping was just to not cope, just move on as though I'd always been that way.
But you seem to understand it a lot better than when we first met. Back then, you were really aloof and impossible to read, and you had absolutely no...
She stopped and looked nervous. He glanced at her.
No filter? You're right. And I'm not that much better now.
You don't walk out of rooms while people are still talking to you nearly as much as you used to,
she said encouragingly.
I guess progress is measured in baby steps.
I know we've talked about this before, but what is it really like not to forget anything?
My personal cloud, you mean? He said, tapping his temple. It's probably a lot like your memory, only mine's a little more neatly organized and a lot more accessible than yours. You have it all up there, too, but some memories are so crowded out by others that you can't reach them anymore. I don't have that problem.
A blessing and a curse.
It is if you have something you'd rather forget, which most of us do.
I know it's hard, Decker.
He stared out the window at an endless sky, which to him, right now, seemed as big as his personal memory.
Life is hard for everybody, Alex. Anybody who says otherwise has just decided to ignore all the shit that comes with waking up every day and walking out the door.
she said.
So your way of coping is focusing entirely on your work?
Decker glanced at her, his features inscrutable.
My way of coping is just finding the truth, Alex. If I can do that, then I can deal with everything else.
Chapter 52. The farm looked like something out of the Grapes of Wrath, only with less dust and a modicum of water sources. They pulled to a stop in front of the plank-sided house and got out. There was a dirty and ancient Jeep two-door parked in the front. They could see a barn in the distance and corrals full of cows, collected around a water trough and salt lick. There was also a paddock where some bow-backed horses nibbled grass. The overall operation looked neat and efficient. The leaning mailbox at the end of the dirt road had said Purdy, so they knew they were in the right place. Before they could reach the front steps, the screen door opened and a woman stood there, a Remington over-under shotgun in hand. She was in her mid-50s, with long gray hair, a slender, wiry build, and a pair of piercing blue eyes. She had on faded dungarees, weathered boots, and a checkered shirt tucked into the pants. The belt holding them up was made of knotted leather. Her face was wrinkled and tanned, and full of suspicion.
"Who are you?"
she demanded. Jameson immediately took out her FBI creds and badge.
"FBI Special Agent Alex Jameson, my partner Amos Decker. Are you Beverly Purdy?"
Instead of de-escalating the situation, this only caused the woman to raise the gun and point it directly at them, her finger near the trigger.
"What the hell do you want? You tell me right now."
Decker stepped forward, putting himself between Jameson and the gun.
"We wanted to talk to Ben, if he's here."
She snapped.
"He's not? But why do you want to talk to him?"
"We're not with the Air Force, if that's what you're thinking. And we have no interest in whether he might be absent without leave. We just want to talk to him about his last posting in London, North Dakota."
"Bullshit. You've come to arrest him."
"Why would we do that?"
"You just said AWOL."
"We're investigating a series of murders in London."
"Ben didn't kill nobody."
"We're not suggesting he did. He was long gone before the killings took place. But he said something to someone back in London. We just wanted to ask him what he meant by that. We believe it might have ties to our investigation."
The woman slowly lowered the weapon.
"He's not here, like I said."
"Was he here at some point?"
"He might have been,"
she said guardedly.
"Do you know where we could find him?"
She shook her head.
"Got no idea. Haven't heard from him in a while."
"And so you must be worried,"
said Jameson, coming to stand next to Decker.
"I'm his ma, of course I'm worried."
"Well, we're worried about him too, so maybe together we can find him."
I don't know."
"I get that you're suspicious, Miss Purdy. So just to show our good faith, we'll leave now. But can I give you our contact information so he could call us if you do see him? All we want to do is talk to him, not arrest him. That's all."
He pulled a card from his jacket pocket and held it out to her. She looked at the paper warily, as though if she touched it, she might feel pain. But apparently now satisfied that they were not here to arrest her son, Purdy said,
"Look, you all want to come in? I just made some fresh coffee."
Decker glanced at Jameson and said,
"Sounds good. It was a long drive. And it's colder here than it was in North Dakota."
They followed her inside. The front room was dominated by heads of animals mounted on the wall. Purdy caught Jameson gawking and said,
"My husband and Ben were avid hunters. Most everybody in these parts are. But it's not just for show. We eat what we shoot."
She led them into a small, plain kitchen with pine cupboards and dark swirl-pattern laminated countertops. The floor was aged linoleum, and the furnishings rustic. The curtains around the windows looked to be about 50 years old. The whole place seemed locked in time from around then. She set the Remington in a gun rack on the wall and pointed to two chairs around the table.
"Take a seat."
They sat while she got the coffee and cups together. After she poured and handed out their drinks, she joined them at the table. She moved a stray hair out of her eyes and sipped her coffee, not meeting their curious gazes.
We understand you live here alone, said Decker. The blue eyes flashed.
Who told you that? You been spying on me?
Her gaze darted to the shotgun.
What do you want? You tell me now.
We already told you, replied Decker calmly, to talk to your son.
That's what you said,
she retorted in a skeptical tone.
Doesn't mean it's true.
It is true,
said Jameson.
We just want to talk to him. We are not here to arrest him. That is not our concern. We have no jurisdiction over his military career.
Feds are feds,
Purdy snapped. It may seem like it, but it doesn't actually work that way. At least not in our case, said Decker. She finally calmed and said,
My husband died 3 years ago. I was hoping Ben would come back here and help me run the place, but that didn't happen.
Decker said, You told us he might have been here. Was he here? Did he talk to you about what might have happened back there that caused him to leave the way he did? Purdy fingered her coffee cup.
They moved everybody from that place, meaning the Air Force, Ben, and the others.
Right, a private security firm named Vector came in to run the facility,
said Jameson.
Don't know about that.
What did he do there? Asked Decker.
Technical stuff, computers and the like.
She snapped her fingers.
Radar, I think he said. But not anymore, I guess.
Why do you say that?
Asked Jameson.
Like I just said, they reassigned Ben and the others. I guess there's nobody left to do the radar and such. He trained for it, you know. He was good at his job, real smart. Always has been.
So he was upset about being transferred out? Asked Decker.
Yeah.
But surely he'd been reassigned before. I mean, you go where the military tells you to. Purdy looked confused by this.
Well, that's right. He was in Nebraska for a while, then Colorado, then he got transferred to North Dakota, so that's right.
He never got upset about those transfers, said Decker.
No.
But he did this time.
He called me one night over a year ago. He said, Ma, they're moving us out. We're going to the East Coast somewhere. I forget where he said, and then they were being reassigned to Colorado, I think. At least he was.
But he didn't go, said Decker. She looked up at him nervously.
You sure you're not here to get him in trouble?
I give you my word. Did he ever say anything to you that showed he was troubled by something?
Not in so many words, no, but I could tell something was bothering him. When he would call, he didn't sound like himself.
Did he know about the changes taking place at the installation?
No, he never mentioned anything like that to me.
Did he ever mention a Colonel Mark Sumter?
No.
Has he been back here since then?
Asked Jameson.
Once,
she said, looking down at her long, weathered fingers.
About 10 months ago. He'd lost weight, wouldn't meet my eye. I asked what was wrong, but all he said was he couldn't tell me without maybe getting me in trouble.
Was he in uniform?
No, he didn't always come home dressed up. But he only had a backpack with him, not big enough for his uniforms and all. I asked him where he was stationed. Out in Colorado, I asked, but he just changed the subject. He said if anybody came looking for him, to just say I hadn't seen hide nor hair of him.
Decker said, And did people come looking for him? She nodded.
The Air Force, 3 times, said he was AWOL, in a lot of trouble. When Ben come here that one time, it was late at night, and he didn't stay long. He left the next morning at the crack of dawn. I told him about the Air Force folks. He said not to worry. I haven't seen him since.
She added gravely, her voice breaking.
Did anyone else ever come looking for him besides the Air Force?
Said Jameson. Purdy took another sip of coffee before answering.
No, just them. Nobody else.
Jameson asked,
Did he have any close friends in North Dakota, anyone he served with, that he might have mentioned? Not that he said, no.
Did he ever mention anyone named Irene Kramer? Asked Decker. Purdy thought about this, but then shook her head.
Not that I recall, no.
Who is she?
One of the people who was killed. Purdy shook her head.
I worry myself sick that Ben's dead, too. He's never gone this long without calling me. What do you all think is going on at that place?
That's what we're trying to find out, said Decker. Does Ben have a room here?
In the back.
Is that where he slept the last time he was here?
Yes.
Do you mind if we have a look?
She rose and led them down the hall. Chapter 53. It was the faded room of a teenager from years ago. Old movie and music posters. Pictures of athletes from 15 years past. A small gunmetal desk with a dusty PlayStation console and a pair of headphones. Some dog-eared Stephen King and Dean Koontz novels, along with books of a technical nature, were lined up on a small bookshelf. The bed was a twin and neatly made. The carpet was old and stained. Decker and Jameson stood in the center of the small space and looked around, while Purdy remained in the doorway, blinking away tears.
I come in here sometimes and sit on his bed,
she said, staring at it.
He's 30 now, enlisted right out of high school. Time goes by so fast, hard to believe. Seems like I just came home from the hospital with him.
Did he have a computer?
Asked Jameson.
One of them laptops, but he took that with him. We don't get real good, whatever it's called, out here.
Internet connection, broadband?
Said Jameson.
Yeah, he would always complain about that, but what can you do? Couldn't up move the dang farm.
Decker opened the closet door and peered inside it. There were a few clothes on hangers. He went through the pockets. On the floor was a cardboard box. He pulled it out and set it on the bed. Inside were some books, magazines, and some loose printed pages. Decker looked at the books and magazines and ran his gaze over the pages. The books and magazines all dealt with technical subjects, mostly having to do with electronic communication applications. The loose pages were about various military installations in Maryland, Colorado, Arkansas, and California. Decker held them up.
Any idea why he was interested in these places?
Purdy came forward and took the pages from him.
I don't know. Maybe he was thinking about asking for a transfer there.
But they're not all Air Force installations,
Jameson said.
Or they could be from when he was thinking about enlisting years ago. He might not have settled on a service branch yet.
No, said Decker, shaking his head. There's a time stamp at the bottom right of the page. It shows when it was printed out.
Jameson looked at the dates.
About a year ago,
she said, giving him a confused look.
You mind if we take these? He asked Purdy.
No, help yourself.
They went back into the kitchen. Purdy said,
Do you think I'll see my son again?
I wish I could give you a straight answer on that, ma'am. I can tell you that we'll do all in our power to find him.
She put a hand on Decker's arm.
Thank you for that.
They took their leave and drove off, with Purdy in the doorway of the little house staring forlornly after them.
I can't imagine what she's going through,
said Jameson.
Her only kid is missing and obviously involved in some dangerous things.
Decker wasn't listening. He was staring down at the pages he had taken, lost in thought. Halfway through the trip, it was well dark. They had just crossed back over into North Dakota when Jameson glanced in the rearview mirror.
Well, that's the first pair of headlights I've seen in a long time.
Decker looked in the side mirror and sat up straighter.
Brace, Alex, he called out right as the front of the vehicle trailing them plowed into the rear of theirs.
The collision slammed both of them back against their seats, momentarily stunning them. Then Jameson went into action. She floored the gas, and the SUV leapt forward.
Can you see anything?
She called out. Decker turned around and looked at the headlights a few feet behind them.
Yeah, and here they come again.
They were bucked forward once more with a second collision. Jameson was having to struggle mightily just to keep the truck on the road. She said,
They have more horsepower than we do. I've got the pedal to the floor.
Well, let's see if we can do something about that.
Decker undid his seat harness, climbed over the seats, and settled in the cargo area at the back.
Pop the window, he called out as he slid his Glock from its belt holster.
Jameson did so, and Decker edged the glass further up. He used the back of the cargo door as his fulcrum, aimed, and fired 5 shots into the driver's side of the windshield. The vehicle immediately started to veer erratically to the left and right.
"Think I hit the driver," he yelled out.
As he said this, he ducked down.
"Look out, Alex."
Their SUV was strafed with machine gun fire. She bent low, cut the wheel hard to the left, and shot onto the wrong side of the road.
"Decker! Decker, you okay? Decker!"
She glanced frantically in the rearview mirror.
"Amos!"
His head poked up into view.
"Okay, that was a little closer than I would have liked."
Their SUV started wobbling badly, and Jameson said,
"They hit our tires. I can't hold this speed."
Decker looked to the right.
"Road coming up. Take it."
Jameson left rubber on the road as she drilled a 90-degree turn onto another ribbon of asphalt heading south. She eased up on the gas because the SUV was fishtailing so badly.
"They must have shredded our rear tires. Feels like we're riding on the rims."
"Just keep going."
He watched as the shot-up vehicle, now revealed as a Hummer, made the turn. And then he watched with a sickening feeling as another Hummer pulled in right behind the first one. They had reinforcements and machine guns. This would not be a long or fair fight. He looked toward the front of their SUV and saw what looked to be an abandoned farmhouse with broken corral fencing and a hay barn with rotted doors swinging off.
"Head for that barn," he told Jameson.
The SUV shot through the opening, and she slammed on the brakes, bringing them to a stop right before they crashed into the opposite wall. They scrambled out of the SUV and took up position behind their vehicle. Decker had already tried to call 911 for help, but there were no bars on his phone. Even if he had, it would probably take hours for even a single cop to show up out here. Jameson had her gun pointed at the open doors. She glanced at Decker.
"What now?"
He was eyeing the interior of the barn, and then his gaze went up.
"High ground is the best."
They hustled to an old wooden ladder and clambered up to the hayloft, which was half full of thoroughly rotted straw. Decker tested each floorboard with his weight before edging over to the hayloft doors and opening them just a crack. Twin pairs of headlights were cutting through the darkness around the farmyard. The doors of the Hummer with the cracked windshield opened, and 4 men climbed out. They wore all black, including ski masks, and carried automatic weapons. The doors of the second Hummer opened, and 3 more men got out. In the blink of an eye, they fanned out, and within seconds they had the barn surrounded. Decker turned back to Jameson.
"Well, our options seem limited."
"Yeah, as in zero,"
she replied grimly. Decker reached into his pocket and pulled out the device Roby had given him. Jameson noted this and said,
"Little late for that."
"I was thinking the same thing, but what do we have to lose now?"
The shots outside drew their attention back to the hayloft doors. As they watched, the lead Hummer exploded, and the detonation lifted the multi-ton vehicle straight up into the air before it slammed back down to earth, a collision that burst all 4 tires.
"What the hell?"
began Jameson. They dropped to the floor and slid backward as automatic gunfire started up again. A few moments later, Decker crawled forward and peered through the crack in the doors. He watched as 2 of the men in black were gunned down. 3 more rushed from around the rear of the barn and took up position behind the destroyed Hummer. They fired into the distance and received return fire. Decker pointed his gun out the crack, took aim, and shot 1 of the men in the back. He fell to the dirt. The other men turned and fired at the barn. Decker slammed the door shut, and he and Jameson took up cover behind a thick bale of rotted hay. Multiple rounds ripped through the wooden doors and into the straw. There was more gunfire, another detonation, screams, more gunfire, shouts, and then the sound of a vehicle starting up. Decker and Jameson crawled forward in time to see the second Hummer racing back down the road. Soon, it had disappeared into the darkness. Jameson looked at Decker and said breathlessly,
"What the hell just happened?"
Before Decker could answer, the phone Roby had given him buzzed. He answered it. Will Roby said,
"You can come down now."
Chapter 54. Roby and Real were in the front seats, and Jameson and Decker in the rear of Real's SUV as they drove back to London. When Jameson and Decker had come out of the barn, they had been met by the pair, along with a number of dead bodies. Roby had introduced Jessica Reel to them. She had said nothing, only nodding curtly in their direction.
"How do you know where we were?"
asked Jameson. Before Roby could answer, Decker held up the phone.
"This has a tracking device."
Roby nodded. "We followed you to your destination, then saw the Hummers on the return trip. It was a close call."
"I wish you didn't have to keep saving my life," said Decker quite frankly. "It's getting a little bit hairy."
"I can see that."
"What did you find out with Purdy's mother?"
asked Reel as she steered the SUV.
"Ben Purdy was last there around 10 months ago. The Air Force has been by looking for him a few times. No one else. We took some things from his room. They may be clues."
He held up the printed pages. Roby took them and looked the pages over.
"A bunch of different military installations. What do you think he was looking for?"
"Facts about something that was important to him."
"You think this has to do with Vector taking over London AFS?" said Roby.
"If you asked me that yesterday, I would have said maybe, but I don't think Purdy was aware it was going to become a prison."
"We thought you might have figured that out," said Roby.
"Purdy was transferred out before any of that happened. He was upset about the transfer, his mother said, but he didn't know the details of what was coming in to replace him and the others. Vector apparently wasn't on the scene yet, and without them around, there weren't going to be any prisoners sent there."
Jameson said,
"So it seems clear that the time bomb Purdy mentioned doesn't involve the prison."
"Little town for so many big things to be happening,"
commented Reel.
"Couldn't have said it better myself,"
remarked Jameson.
Roby said, "The guys we took care of back there looked just like the ones who tried to ambush me the other night."
"We figured you were involved in all that," said Decker.
Roby glanced at Reel.
"But for my partner here, they would have had to send someone else to take my place."
Reel said,
"We all do our part."
Roby continued,
"They're clearly mercenaries, and there are a shitload of them out for hire. Anyone with enough money can have their pick of some very serious people."
"But again, why London, North Dakota, for all the attention?"
said Jameson.
"Time bomb," said Decker,
as he glanced down at the printed pages Roby had handed back to him.
"And apparently, these folks want to make damn sure it goes off."
The knock came on Decker's door about an hour after they got back to London. Considering what had happened to them, Decker answered the door with his Glock in hand. It was Roby.
"Got a minute?" he asked.
They sat in two chairs facing each other. Roby looked grim.
"I take it you have bad news," said Decker.
"They got to Beverly Purdy. She's dead."
Decker sat back and slowly absorbed this not-so-surprising news. What else could they do? They had no idea what Ben had told his mother, or him, and Jameson. It was surprising that they hadn't killed her before. But then there was a simple answer to that.
"So when we went there, we signed her death warrant," said Decker. "They obviously followed us out there."
"I doubt it would have mattered," said Roby. "She was a loose end. They would have gotten to her at some point."
Decker stood and looked out the window into the darkness.
"I'm a cop, Roby, and right now I feel like I'm in the middle of a James Bond film. I have no experience with shit like this."
Roby didn't respond right away, but when he did, it was in a calm, judicious tone.
"The world hasn't gotten safer over time, Decker. It's just gotten more complicated. Humans are still in control, and humans do bad things all the time. We had the Cold War with nukes, and now we have hotspots all over with people slaughtering other people and dictators rising up again because democracy seems stalemated and nothing gets done and people get fed up. But a dictator doesn't need supporters. He just needs followers. And the best way to make people follow, at least in the eyes of guys like that, is to give them no choice in the matter."
Decker sat back down.
"Thanks for the geopolitical education, but it still doesn't get us where we need to go."
"Jessica Reel and I are here to help you. Our strengths are in protection and in removing people in the most efficient way possible."
"I've seen your handiwork."
Your strength is figuring things out. So, any ideas? You said the prison thing is not the big deal here. And for what it's worth, our boss agrees with you.
Does he have any ideas? Asked Decker.
Not that he's shared, but from what I could gather, he has a strategy about the prison issue that he's going to pull the trigger on. We'll let him handle that piece. You focus on the time bomb.
Decker eyed him skeptically.
You're not authorized to operate in this country.
So the law says.
Well, you seem to be operating okay.
Roby rose.
You should get some sleep.
What I should do is start to figure this out.
Chapter 55. Blue Man sat in a leather chair at a prestigious club within a stone's throw of the Capitol building. Silent men in starched livery walked around carrying trays with expensive whiskeys and bowls of cheap nuts. The walls were paneled with luxurious wallpaper, and on them were hung portraits of old, grave men in suits. The carpet underfoot had several inches of give. The furnishings were old but originally expensive. Newspapers rustled alongside murmurings of educated, cultured voices and clinks of ice cubes and cocktail glasses as both business and government leaders made decisions that would have massive impact on millions of people, all without their knowledge or consent. If one did not know better, it could have been 1920 rather than a century later. Blue Man's gaze roamed the room. He nodded to those he liked and respected, and also to those he loathed and distrusted, but to whom some level of acknowledgement was required. It certainly said something that he had been in this business so long that the latter group far outnumbered the former. His gaze finally alighted on the stout man who came into the room, carrying a folded newspaper and a glass half full of gin and tonic, along with a self-important look. Blue Man rose and approached him.
Patrick, he said.
Patrick McIntosh, the gentleman who had met with Colonel Mark Sumter in that little house over 1,000 miles from here, stared back at him, his features instantly wary.
Roger, how are you?
Blue Man's real name was Roger Walton. He had almost no occasion now to ever use it, but this was one of those times.
Not bad, not bad. You? Things are going very well, thank you.
Do you have a moment? Said Blue Man.
I've engaged a private room.
The smile that McIntosh had forced onto his lips retreated to a straight line one might employ after being sworn in to testify in front of a hostile congressional committee.
A private room? Why the need for that? He chuckled. Am I going to get the third degree?
We've both been around long enough to know the answer to that, replied Blue Man genially, and also largely unresponsively, as he placed a firm grip on McIntosh's elbow. Oh, and Director Cassidy sends her best.
So you've spoken with Rachel,
said McIntosh, as Blue Man led him down a dark paneled corridor to a door that opened into a 10x10 windowless room with two upholstered chairs facing one another.
She is my superior, after all. I meant, had you spoken to her about me?
Not to sound like a cliché, but that would be classified. Blue Man tacked on a smile, which seemed to relieve McIntosh.
I'm glad I'm no longer in the public sector. You should make the jump, Roger. A man with your experience and Rolodex, the money you could make.
My needs are simple. My salary more than ample.
I just bought an Italian villa in Tuscany. Sherry and I will spend the summers there.
Congratulations. Please have a seat. The men faced off in the chairs. McIntosh laid his paper aside but did drain the rest of his gin.
I've been traveling, said Blue Man. Oh, really? Where? I hope somewhere nice. South of France? Rome? Sydney?
London.
Oh, very nice.
London, North Dakota. McIntosh set the empty glass down on a table next to his chair. To his credit, his hand remained sure and steady, noted Blue Man.
Did you enjoy your time there, wherever that is? North Dakota, you said?
It was instructive, but surely your memory fails you.
Come again?
Blue Man slid an envelope and a small digital recorder from his pocket.
He took his time opening the envelope and slipped out a number of photos.
You look distinguished in these photos, Patrick. It was quite hot that night, if I recall. Your colleague, or more accurately, your co-conspirator, Colonel Mark Sumter, decided not to dress in uniform. It was so toasty. He opted for civilian clothes.
McIntosh glanced at the photos as Blue Man fanned them out, but said nothing in reply. Next, Blue Man set the recorder down and hit the start button. The conversation between McIntosh and Sumter wafted over the small room. When it was finished, Blue Man shut off the machine and settled back in his chair.
Well? Well what?
Do you not feel that explanations are in order?
Not at all, said McIntosh offhandedly.
I see. Well then, let me speak for a bit and see if what I have to say prompts you to rethink that answer.
I doubt that it will.
Blue Man said, Guantanamo hasn't accepted any new prisoners since 2008. The current cost of the remaining prisoners there, all 100 of them, is around $1.3 billion in change. McIntosh picked a piece of lint off his sleeve.
Is it? My goodness. Hardly a bargain to house savages like that.
Granted, but it is authorized. McIntosh flicked away the piece of lint.
Are we done here yet? Because frankly, I'm not following any of this.
You're on the board of Vector Security.
I know I am. A wonderful, patriotic company.
With only one contract approved by the government, namely to operate the Douglas S. George Defense Complex, aka London Air Force Station.
I hope it doesn't surprise you that I was already aware of that, hence my visit there. I am a good board member, after all.
You're not only a board member, you also have a direct financial interest in the business of Vector.
As board members so often do.
The budget for the complex is $644,976,000 per annum.
It's expensive keeping us safe. Now, if you'll excuse me.
McIntosh started to rise from his seat. Which means the cost of each of the 10 prisoners currently housed there is over $64 million. Hardly a bargain compared to Gitmo's $13 million per pop. McIntosh sat down.
Prisoners? What on earth are you talking about, Roger? Have you suffered a stroke or something?
Blue Man took out additional photos that Roby had taken, showing the men being wheeled off to ambulances. I'm talking about these men.
Could be anyone, said McIntosh, glancing at them. Looks like some Air Force personnel in distress. As you said, it gets hot out there.
They're not Air Force personnel, as you well know.
You say, I say.
Blue Man's expression now hardened. This back and forth grows wearisome, and you are not the only item on my agenda for today. He leaned forward. Vector's COO and CFO also say, as does Colonel Sumter, they're ISIS, Taliban, and Al-Qaeda prisoners taken from the battlefields and smuggled into this country without the knowledge of government leadership. McIntosh's eyelids rose a bit more fully, revealing his pale blue eyes.
You've talked to Sumter?
We actually couldn't get him to stop talking once he saw the trouble he was in.
I don't see it that way at all. And contrary to your observation, it was all approved, with a nice little bow on top.
What was approved a very long time ago and never revisited was the operation of London AFS as a Parks radar array monitoring facility, which function it was performing up until about a year ago. Then its purpose dramatically shifted. It has the same quasi-pyramidal building as its cousin in Grand Forks, and the same impressive surveillance system. However, since we already have one of those in North Dakota, and the one at Grand Forks is newer and better positioned, a spare was not really needed. But that's certainly not the first time the Pentagon has had redundancies and wasted money. So a complex out in the hinterlands, with a duplicative purpose? You must have felt like a pot of gold had been dropped into your lap, because that made it the perfect facility to house additional unauthorized prisoners who should never have been brought into this country, to torture them, and then dispose of them when they had told all they could or refused to do so.
And then you would pass along this intelligence to others in government, under the subterfuge that it had come through ordinary channels. The ambulances? They might as well have been meat wagons for the bodies, which we are right now digging up, by the way, based on information provided to us. McIntosh sat back.
I commend the speed with which you have moved on this, Roger. I really do.
The federal government is like an aircraft carrier. It takes us a while to get going, but once we do, look out.
Yes, indeed.
McIntosh managed to tack on a smile, even as his skin grew as gray as the side of a naval vessel. Blue Man next took out the photos Roby had given him of the people getting off the jet. I wondered why Vector was given the contract, since the capabilities of their people are not known to be in the park's space. But the VP of operations for Vector is well known to me. He headed up security at Gitmo for 6 years, and here he is with two of his top lieutenants arriving at London AFS. Blue Man held up the photos for McIntosh to see. He, of course, has also been arrested, and from what I understand, he is already attempting to make a deal. The CFO and COO have already received blanket immunity in return for their testimony. It may well be that you're the odd man out on that, Patrick, which is why I saved you for last, if for no other reason than I don't like you and never have. McIntosh made a hissing sound as he sucked on his tongue.
Why are you even involved in this? You are barred from operating in this country. I think you left me a hole to climb through.
We are an intelligence agency tasked with protecting this country from enemies, both foreign and domestic. We have worked in conjunction with the FBI this entire time. They are the lead agency on this. We merely their very willing helpmate. That type of arrangement occurs all the time and has been thoroughly vetted in the courts. Thus, you will find that not only is there no hole for you to escape through, but that the roof over your head for your remaining time on this earth will be provided by the federal government.
Roger, I think if we discuss this civilly...
Blue Man spoke over him. The long and the short of it is you are running a secret and unauthorized prison, using government funds that were meant to pay for a fully operational eye in the sky, with the result that you are charging the American taxpayer many times what it costs to house prisoners at Gitmo, which was an alarmingly high rate to begin with. In the last year, your good CFO has calculated that, thus far, profits to Vector have exceeded nearly $500 million, which is, by any standard, an outrageous margin of return. I trust you understand that Uncle Sam frowns on gouging like that. In fact, he frowns on it so much that there are multiple laws against it, all of which you have broken.
We were doing good, Roger. The information we received and passed along
has not resulted in anything positive. Almost all of it has been proven erroneous and thus useless. The rest of it was already known through legitimate intelligence sources. He paused. Let me be as clear as I possibly can be. This was not about helping this country. This was about lining your pocket. So please do not plead patriotism as your defense. You'll only embarrass yourself and make me even angrier than I already am. As Blue Man had been speaking, McIntosh had sunken lower and lower in his very fine and very expensive chair. Blue Man continued, It speaks to the appallingly large and frustratingly complex footprint of the DOD that such a scheme could have worked in the first place, and that it's taken so long for the truth to come out. But with an overall budget of nearly $1 trillion, thousands of facilities all over the globe, millions of employees and contractors, billions of square feet of space, and enough divisions and departments and programs that the right hand literally isn't even aware that there is a left hand, it wasn't that difficult to hide this sort of thing. The budget at London, though obscenely out of whack, doesn't even register as a blip on the Pentagon's overall spending. You, of course, had allies within the Air Force, the Pentagon, and the Congress to help you bury the truth, whom your CFO has helpfully provided information about, including significant 6- and 7-figure payoffs. My director has been fully briefed on this and has communicated this in writing to the director of the FBI and the IGs of the Air Force and the DOD. And lastly, again to be as transparent as possible, a warrant for your arrest is being issued,
as we speak. Blue Man rose and smoothed out his dress shirt and tie. Now I'm going to leave before I do or say something I might regret. However, I would suggest that you make plans to sell your vacation home in Italy. I don't see much opportunity for you to use it. And you might need the additional funds for legal fees. And please dissuade yourself from any thoughts of fleeing. As soon as you leave this room, there will be multiple eyes on you until your arrest warrant is executed. Thank you for your time. He pointed at the empty glass. And you might want to get yourself another drink, Patrick. Goodbye. We will not be meeting again. Blue Man closed the door behind him. Chapter 56. The Douglas S. George Defense Complex was buzzing. As Decker and Jameson drove there in their new rental SUV, they saw the line of vehicles heading in and some heading out. A line of choppers was coming in, and a small jet was taking off. They passed the oil rig nearest the facility, the All-American Energy Company, and found workers standing there staring at all the activity going on with their neighbor. They also spotted several members of the brothers riding on farm equipment in their fields, doing the very same thing. They were here because Roby had called Decker and told him to come here as fast as possible. Someone had obviously authorized their clearance into the facility because they were passed swiftly through after presenting their creds. Roby and Real came out to meet them as they pulled to a stop in front of the building where they had initially met with Colonel Mark Sumpter. They followed the pair down the hall and entered a small room where Blue Man sat at the head of a small, battered conference table. He motioned for them to sit, then spent the next 20 or so minutes filling them in on recent developments, including his confrontation with Patrick McIntosh back in Washington. Your agency is taking the lead on the law enforcement side, and the DOJ will, of course, deal with the prosecutions. So it was prisoners, as we suspected, said Decker. Yes. Some in positions of power, and who should have known better, deemed it a worthy project to restart what was done at Abu Ghraib prison and other locations, despite the complete debacle that turned out to be. I am cheered by the fact that my agency had learned its lesson and was not party to a second go-round with this sort of thing.
How many prisoners died?
Asked Jameson. At least a dozen, if not more. Information is still coming in. It will take a while to dig through it all.
The locals are certainly curious about what's going on here,
said Jameson. It will all be hushed up in due time, said Blue Man. This show of force is really for those out there who might have information, or for those who are as yet unknown to us, but are involved and will now panic and attempt to flee. Your director likened it to sending hunting dogs into the brush to flush out the quail.
But the truth will come out,
said Jameson. Not in the press, no. It would cause more trouble than is warranted. People need to have faith in their government. Decker said, Well, maybe the government might want to consider earning that faith. I'm utterly in agreement with you, but now we must move on. Decker gave him an appraising look. This case is closed, but this was not the ticking time bomb. Purdy was gone before the prison became active, and I'm convinced this has to do with something that happened a long time ago. Which is why I requested your presence here, in addition to wanting to fill you in on what had happened here. How can we assist you? I'm surprised that you're not packing up to go home, said Decker. Let me explain it this way. If an international presence exists on American soil for a purpose to do harm to America and its citizens, then we can very clearly justify our continued presence in this matter. I don't know about you, but I do not want a second 9/11 to happen because we got caught up in a bureaucratic tussle. Okay, I need to see Ben Purdy's service record. What do you hope to find in it? A lead, because right now, we don't have one. Decker put down his third cup of coffee, glanced at the remains of a largely uneaten meal, and settled back in his chair in the hotel restaurant. He opened the email he'd just gotten on his phone and did likewise with the email's attachment. It was Ben Purdy's service record. He had joined the Air Force straight out of high school and had spent the next dozen years in uniform. Decker went methodically through screen after screen. Purdy had covered a lot of ground in his career and had sought a great many educational and training opportunities that the Air Force had offered. He'd even attended conferences overseas in England, Germany, Qatar, and India. By all accounts, he was a brilliant techie, though he had grown up in modest circumstances and had not been able to afford to go to college. He had risen to the rank of technical sergeant, which the document said was a very difficult rank to achieve, and Purdy had done it in record time. He had been on pace to make master sergeant when he had disappeared. Decker sipped his coffee and then focused on actions that Purdy had taken in the last 16 months, figuring that whatever ticking time bomb he had come across would have dated from more recent times. Purdy had briefly left London AFS during that time to take a class offered in D.C. on the latest types of communication technology available, and also what might be coming in the future. That made sense for a specialist like Purdy. After that, he had taken other offered courses in a variety of specialties, none of which could reasonably lead Decker to a ticking time bomb. His phone buzzed. It was Bogart. "Hey, Ross."
"Decker, I've heard about London AFS. Something big is going down, and the Bureau is involved."
"I know, but it doesn't explain our case."
"Well, I dug up what I could on the military record of Bradley Unger Daniels."
"Anything of interest?"
"He served at London AFS from 1955 until 1987.
"I guess that makes sense. He had been an aviation navigator in the war, and he was into radar."
"Right, but the most interesting thing I found was that parts of his record were redacted and marked classified."
Decker sat up straighter.
"He told us he couldn't talk about his time at London because it was classified. I thought he was just messing with us. But why would it be classified? Just because it was about looking for nukes during the Cold War?"
"I don't know, Decker. I can't get a straight answer from anyone."
"So a dead end?"
"I'm afraid so, unless you can think of another path forward."
"Well, that's my job."
Decker clicked off and stared down at Purdy's service record while he thought about Bogart's words. He could see only one way forward. He phoned Jameson.
"It's time we cracked Bud," he said.
Chapter 57. Jameson and Decker arrived at Green Hills Nursing Home and were once more taken to the supervisor's office. Her face turned red when she saw them.
"You upset him greatly. I can't believe you're back."
Decker stared her down.
"We're back because Brad Daniels is a key witness in a case that has national security interests. Now, if you won't let us see him, a whole army of feds is going to come down on you and this facility like a ton of bricks. Your call."
The woman's hostile look quickly faded.
"Are you serious?"
"We would not be here otherwise."
"All right, but please don't upset him again."
"All I can do is ask the questions I have to ask. If he gets upset, that's an answer in itself."
She led them to Daniel's room. The old man was sitting in the corner in his wheelchair, the cane clutched in his hands.
"Who is it?"
he snapped as he heard them come in.
"Mr. Daniels, you have some visitors,"
said the woman.
"What visitors? It's not Christmas, is it?"
"I'll let them explain,"
she said sweetly. Then she fled the room. Decker and Jameson came forward.
"Mr. Daniels," he said.
The old man started.
"It's you! I recognize your voice! Can't see no more, but I recognize voices! Get the hell out of here!"
"You can either answer our questions, or other people will come here and ask them."
"I don't give a rat's ass! Get out!"
"Part of your military service record was redacted, classified."
"Well, hell, I told you that."
"But you didn't say why."
"I can't, dumbass. That's sort of the point of it being classified."
"More people have been killed," said Decker. "Several more. Something big is being planned. We need you to help us understand what that could be."
"I only have your word for that, and I don't believe you. You're not pulling the wool over my eyes. For all I know, you're spies."
"We can show you our credentials,"
offered Jameson.
"Can't see him. I told you that."
Decker sat on the edge of the bed.
"Is there anything you can tell us about your time at London AFS?"
"No."
"We've been there. We've seen the radar array."
"So?"
"It's funny."
"What is?"
"They have an identical facility near Grand Forks, North Dakota.
A hint of a smile crept across Daniels' features.
Is that right? But you knew that, didn't you?
The smile vanished.
Who says?
It was discovered that the facility was being used for another purpose just recently. Not an eye in the sky, but something totally different.
Who cares?
Your help could be vital to the national security interests of this country.
Again, says you. You're not tricking me. I gave an oath.
You've been out of uniform a long time.
An oath is an oath. Take it to my grave. Just how it's done.
Decker looked at Jameson in frustration.
Is there anything we can say to make you change your mind?
Said Jameson.
Yeah, you could get the President of the United States of America to order me to give it up. Other than that, fuck off.
You're the only one left from that time at London AFS.
Last man standing, cackled Daniels.
So you're the only one who can help us prevent something really bad from happening.
It's lunchtime. I can smell the onions. I'm going to the dining room.
He wheeled his chair forward, managed to ease it past the bed and wall, then maneuvered it through the doorway.
For a blind guy, he navigates pretty well,
said Jameson.
He's obviously not going to talk, said Decker.
Jameson said,
I'm surprised they haven't come here and killed him, too. I mean, look at poor Beverly Purdy.
If Irene Kramer never gave him up, they probably would have no way of knowing.
But if they followed us here and found out we asked him questions, that's probably how Beverly Purdy died.
Good point, Alex. I'll have some security put here to guard against that.
He got up to leave, but then glanced at the nightstand. He picked up Daniels' ball cap. Jameson joined him.
Shows the unit at the Air Force he was assigned to,
she said.
Lots of veterans have them.
Right, but that's not all.
Decker pointed to a series of metal pins that were attached to the hat.
Look at these.
Places where he worked, sort of like merit badges he earned?
Observed Jameson. Decker ran his eye over all of them, until they held on one. He shoved the hat into his pocket.
Let's get out of here before Daniels comes back and notices his hat is missing.
He said he can't see.
He said a lot of things. I don't believe any of them.
So what's with the hat?
A clue. Maybe a really big one.
Chapter 58
USACC, said Decker.
They were driving back to London from the nursing home. Decker was holding the hat and looking at the pins. One in particular had drawn his focus.
USACC, what does that stand for?
Decker took out his phone and searched for the meaning.
United States Army Chemical Corps, he said.
But Daniels was Air Force, not Army.
He still has the pin. And that's not all.
He unclipped several of the pins from the hat and held them up.
Beale Air Force Base, Rocky Mountain Arsenal, Camp Dietrich, Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Some of them are Army, some Air Force. And Camp Dietrich is in Maryland, and now it's Fort Dietrich.
So he spent time at all of them?
Apparently enough time to earn a pin.
What do they do at those places?
The question is, what did they do when Daniels was in the military?
He paused.
And there's something else. From his service record, I learned that Purdy spent time at Beale and Rocky Mountain Arsenal.
Okay, that's a definite connection.
And that's not all. The printed pages we found in his closet of the military facilities, they're all places that Daniels has pins from.
I would definitely call that a big clue,
replied Jameson. She saw Decker glancing in the side mirror. She did the same in the rear view.
I don't see anybody back there,
she said.
I was just checking after last time.
They arrived back in London. Decker and Jameson went immediately to her hotel room, where Jameson logged on to her computer. Decker had given her Daniels' hat with all of the pins, and she had searched each of them online. 20 minutes later, she was finished and sat back. She glanced at Decker, her face pale and her expression one of slight panic.